Item 14, which begins as a briefing. This is the Elwha moratorium briefing and then the tour. And while staff are coming up to the table, commissioners, are we all planning to attend the tour? Everybody? Yes. We probably should carpool, so we need to work that out. And I think we would also like an opportunity to put on our field dress before we take off. So
I know.
So we can at least work out a carpool among ourselves. Director and Deputy Director, are you both coming? So are you going to change into your field dudes? Okay, so maybe among us we can work out carpools at least.
I have a vehicle that I can take three of them.
Okay.
I think probably three vehicles. I don't know how many staff are going.
Yeah.
Two.
Myself.
And Ron.
Okay, so.
Four. So I think three vehicles. If everybody could get, if they can get four in a vehicle.
Are you coming?
I don't think I'll go in that.
Okay.
It should work.
Yeah, parking's limited up there.
So yeah, that's what. Okay. So, great. So we've got one vehicle volunteer and two vehicle volunteer, although it's a little small. It's a, okay. So we got.
My car's messy.
Three.
It is two, but I'm still good.
Okay. So Jim and Jay and Dave are going to. You've got Boku room, don't you? Yeah. Okay. It sounds like that'll work.
One more.
Great. Yes.
Just thank you, Madam Chair. While we're waiting for staff to get ready, that seems like they are ready. But one more kind of new guy question about the end of the public testimony. And I meant to ask it this morning as well. But we've heard some ideas during public testimony. At what point does the commission consider reacting to the public testimony that's not on this agenda?
Well, there's not a really formal part of the agenda. There are a number of ways that we react to it. Some will take to committee, which you've raised. Blue sheets is another way, and things that we've been discussing. There are a number of ways that we react. We do want to assure the public that we do listen and take public testimony very seriously, and we do react even though there is not a formal okay, this is what we're going to do about the public testimony on the agenda.
So at the very end, under discussion and debrief,
yes.
For example, we've heard a lot about halibut. We heard about some guiding things.
Yes.
This morning.
Yes.
Is that an opportunity?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And it's often taken as an opportunity. So, yeah. And I just, we've been discussing how we're going to get to the Elwha tour. I would just remind public who are interested, this is part of the meeting. It is an open meeting, so public is welcome to this tour. Okay. Annette and Joe.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Commission Director Unsworth, Deputy Director Storer, thank you for the opportunity to come here and talk to you about the Elwha River. I'm Dr. Annette Hoffman. I'm the Fish Regional Program Manager in Region 6, and with me is Dr. Joe Storer.
Just those Joes.
Dr. Joe Anderson. He's a research scientist with the Fish Program Science Division. What we'd like to do today is talk first about the fish moratorium that's in place right now, and then some of the factors that went into that that decision and the extension that happened, and then transition into how is the recovery process going, since those two are very much linked, and then talk about future expectations. So to begin, the Elwha River has had two dams on it that were removed. The Elwha River Ecosystem and Fisheries Restoration Act, which was signed in 1992 by the U.S. Congress, set in motion a series of actions that led to the removal of both of the dams. The commencement of dam removal was in 2011, with the Elwha Dam being removed in 2012, and the upper dam, Glines Canyon Dam, in 2014. There was additional rock blasting that had to happen to improve passage in an area below between those two dams. And as you can see from this map, the dams were fairly low in the river, so there's a lot of habitat to recolonize in this recovery effort. So to assist with that recovery effort, there was a 5-year moratorium in place for the Elwha River and its tributaries placed in February of 2011. That moratorium was put in place because with a restoration project of this scale and so much sediment that had to make its way down the river, there was the need to provide, you know, maximum protection for the fish resources to recover during that period. So a lot of the sediment, and I think Dr. Anderson will go through a lot more detail about where we are in that particular process. The fish enclosure was applied to all recreational and commercial fishing in the Elwha River, and however, the mountain lakes and Lake Sutherland remained open to sport fishing from a season, you know, our typical season for fourth Saturday in April to the end of October. Then in 2017, this last spring, the moratorium was extended to maximize the recolonization of the habitats upstream. So that rock removal of that one last passage issue really meant that, you know, the fish are just starting to, I mean, they're getting up above the dam sites, but they're just starting to get up above the dam site. So there's still a bit more of a work to do there. So what I'd like to do now is turn this over to Dr. Anderson to talk about where are we in the recovery process and what does that look like for our future.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners, Director, Deputy Director, for the chance to talk today about the Elwha.
I want to start by just saying I've been working for the department for 4.5 years. I've been conducting research on the Elwha in that time frame, which is pretty small relative to the, you know, administrators, restoration planners, biologists that have dedicated a big chunk of their career to this impressive project. So there's simply too many storylines relative to the Elwha to pack into a 20-minute conversation or presentation. I'm going to do my best to hit the highlights. My focus has been on fish population status, especially the Chinook salmon and the role that the hatchery there plays. And so I'm going to necessarily understate and perhaps miss altogether some important storylines that others have contributed to. So I want to start by just simply showing you some images of the dam removal itself. So this is Elwha Dam. And the way this proceeded here, these images were taken with a time-lapse camera operated by the Park Service, was by deconstructing the dam and then essentially using heavy equipment to flip the channel back and forth, sort of on the right side and the left side of the screen there, periodically. Until it was eventually removed, and that's what you'd see if you went up to the viewing site today. So that process took about 6 to 8 months. By spring of 2012, Elwha Dam was removed. So Glines Canyon Dam, which is the first spot we'll go to on the tour, so you can literally stand on the precipice of the dam and sort of look upstream at former Lake Mills. This process was just a little bit different. In this case, there was a impact hammer mounted on an excavator there in that barge that would jog back and forth and notch the dam down. Process was a little bit slower, so it was summer of 2014 by the time Glines Canyon Dam was removed. Last stages of dam removal there. And there's the canyon in the absence of the dam. So I think one of the real big storylines here is while this dam removal presented immense opportunities for salmon recovery in the long term, in the short term it was a major disturbance. There was a lot of sediment retained by the two reservoirs, so Lake Mills upstream of Glines Canyon Dam, Lake Aldwell upstream of Elwha Dam. So 21 million cubic meters of sediment was estimated by the interagency hydrology team. So most of that was in Lake Mills. At this point, approximately two-thirds of that total has been eroded from both of the reservoirs. That was transmitted downstream over a period of years. And so pools filled, the river itself increased in height, graded, as we say, up to a meter or a meter and a half. What that means is that it was pretty unstable salmon habitat, so any fish that spawned in the main stem of the river itself encountered some pretty hostile rearing conditions. There were refuges in some of the tributaries that were unaffected by dam removal, but this was a pretty significant disturbance. 90% of that material was eventually delivered to coastal habitats. I actually contacted a lot of the leaders on the hydrology team over the last week or so and just sort of inquired about what the kind of current status is. And they said that the message is largely that the erosion is mostly complete at this point. There will be some additional erosion at higher flow events, but for the most part, what's remaining in the reservoirs, except for some high flows, will likely be there. And so the greatest remaining impact to the salmon habitat in the main river itself at this point is really in the floodplain channels, which served as sinks for a lot of that sediment where it was deposited but was not subsequently moved downriver. Whereas in the main stem, it really was a wave of sediment that coursed downstream. So to illustrate that, I've plotted turbidity. So it's really a measure of the degree to which light is scattered and by suspended solids in a liquid. So these measurements were taken downstream of both dam sites. And I've also shown in red there is an approximate lethal threshold for salmonids. Now I say approximate because there's a lot of factors that would govern lethal levels and notably the duration of exposure. But the point here is that at times these turbidity levels measured on the y-axis there were likely lethal to fish that were in that main channel of the river. On the x-axis, I've got time, so just showing some of the major milestones when dam removal began, removal of Elwha Dam, the removal of Glines Canyon Dam, and then the rockfall blasting that Annette mentioned. And the point here is that those peaks, those pulses of material moving downriver coincided with dam removal activities, but also sort of winter storms where flows were higher and had the greater ability to mobilize that material.
Just a quick question. I'm curious what the units are for turbidity, FBU and FNU?
Yeah. So FBU is Formazin backscatter units. FNU is Formazin nephelometric units. So they're just different ways to measure the degree to which light is refracted by material suspended in the liquid.
And it is FBU per FNU?
No. So the blue line is FNU. The sort of orangish line
Okay.
is FBU. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And so the FNU, I believe, is more sensitive at low to moderate levels, whereas the FBU sort of is able to capture those real peaks.
I see.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And so all that material was delivered, or a lot of it, 90% of it, was delivered to the coastal habitats and where it actually created habitat for fish. And this is a really compelling storyline with respect to the dam removal project. And you can see from this image here the degree to which that estuary, which had been starved from sediment and woody debris for over a century, has just in the last few years really grown. It's developed a complex network of intertidal channels, and estuaries, Eric mentioned earlier, are really critical sort of bottlenecks in terms of survival, particularly for Chinook salmon, as well as chum salmon. So it's pretty exciting. A team led by Ann, who just provided testimony, has been sampling that estuary for many years. They're seeing fish that are using those habitats, not just salmonids, but a variety of forage fish species as well, and that really bodes well for survival and recruitment and returns to the river in the future. So in terms of the fish and how they've responded to dam removal, you know, the first point I would like to make is that we've got a really diverse assemblage of species in the Elwha River. So we've got 8 species of salmonids. We've got a listed species of smelt, eulachon, Pacific lamprey, and the information that we have with respect to these different species varies quite a bit. A lot of the highest quality information is on Chinook salmon and steelhead. They've been a focus of monitoring efforts because of their status as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. And so a lot of the data I'll show here are focusing on those two species. So in terms of the monitoring work itself, the fish monitoring team has developed a plan, some guidelines to shape the monitoring work and the way that information is used to inform management, particularly of hatchery management. And the monitoring adaptive management guidelines have four phases. So I'm just going to walk through those. And the idea is that the management activities would change as the data tell us that we're shifting from the first phase to the second phase and on down the line. So in the first phase, we're focused on preservation. And the idea here is that that dam removal itself really was a significant disturbance to the river. And the primary management tool is that we're using hatcheries as a means to provide a measure of demographic insurance against what we anticipated to be low survival of fish that were exposed to those hostile rearing conditions. The second phase is recolonization, where the focus really is getting as many fish as possible to access those habitats above the dam. So the rockfall blasting was a measure here where we were intending to make sure that the passage was adequate to get fish, you know, where they needed to be upstream of these dams. Third phase is local adaptation, and in this part of the recovery process, the key sort of element is we're essentially trying to reduce the influence of the hatcheries, where the hatchery production is reduced to the degree that the naturally spawning fish are subject to the natural selection in the river itself and are adapting traits that are advantageous to the local river conditions without the need for that demographic supplementation provided by the hatchery. And then lastly, in the viable natural population phase, we've got a self-sustaining natural population that's productive enough to withstand harvest without the need for hatchery supplementation. And the guidelines and the plan are pretty clear that, the long-term goal is associated with a self-sustaining natural population. It's kind of a busy plot here, but I think this really illustrates a lot of the key components of these monitoring and adaptive management guidelines. So across the columns there in blue, we are showing the four phases of recovery. So again, preservation, recolonization, local adaptation, and viable natural population. And then the rows shown here over on the left are the sort of titles of the categories. We've got our monitoring metrics. So Eric Netherland mentioned or spoke earlier today about VSP monitoring or viable salmonid population monitoring. So we've got metrics for abundance, productivity, spatial distribution, and diversity, as well as PHOS or proportion hatchery origin spawners. So that's a key metric that we're keeping track of. And the idea is that these numbers represent our targets are our goals. And so, for instance, when we are able to achieve the metrics meeting this column here, in the preservation phase, we'd move into the recolonization phase, and our management actions, the way we manage the populations, would adapt to that decision. So for the next few slides, I'm going to walk through some data for each of these primary monitoring categories, so abundance, productivity, spatial distribution, and diversity. So first, I want to talk about abundance. So the simple question here is how many adult salmon return to the Elwha River? To make those estimates, we're using a pretty a new technology, at least deployed in rivers, using sonar, where you're essentially transmitting sound waves into the river channel itself and then using that imagery to count fish. It's a fancy fish finder, I suppose, in a matter of speaking, but it became really handy in those years when the river was really turbid typical methods weren't that effective. So in combination with the sonar, which is operated by independent contractor Keith Denton, the crews use sampling at the hatcheries as well as the spawning grounds to evaluate for hatchery marks. So we use cut of wire tags, adipose fin clips, and thermal otolith marks, again mentioned by Eric previously in the presentation, to identify the hatchery fish. This plot here simply shows those abundance estimates from Keith's sonar project. So on the left, we've got Chinook salmon. On the right, we've got steelhead. In the red, we've plotted the total abundance of natural plus hatchery origin fish. And so those are these values here. And in the blue, we are basically only showing our estimate of natural origin fish. So what you can see is that the population is really dominated at this point by hatchery origin fish, over 95% in all years that we've been measuring. And then up here, I'm plotting the long-term goal for that last phase of the viable natural population. So the take-home message is we're a long way from that long-term goal. Similarly for steelhead, again, natural plus hatchery origin in red, the blue just being the natural origin fish relative to our long-term goal. So still far short of that long-term goal. In terms of productivity, our primary metric is the number of returning adults per spawner. And so that's plotted on the y-axis. And so the way to interpret this graph is that for each year, for say fish spawning in 2004, the y-axis represents the number of returning adults that returned as two-year-olds in 2006, three-year-olds in 2007, or four-year-olds in 2008. And so a really key threshold here is a value of 1, which would indicate for each spawner there's a returning adult in the next generation. That's your replacement threshold. So if you're below replacement, then the population's abundance is declining over time, and that's really what we've been seeing. And these data really lend credence to the fact that the hatchery's been used to sort of maintain the existence of this stock. Without that demographic input, we likely would see exceedingly low abundances. So in terms of spatial structure, we use our traditional red surveys, which allow us to estimate the distribution of spawning sites throughout the watershed. So I'm just showing a few maps of the steelhead spawning sites in yellow in three different reaches. So the Elwha Dam to the mouth, so this was the section that was accessible to fish while the dams were in place. What we call the middle Elwha, which is from Elwha Dam all the way up to Glines Canyon Dam. And you can see a significant amount of spawning in this newly accessible habitat, particularly in two tributaries here. So this is Little River, and this is Indian Creek. These are really key habitats that served as refugia during that time period when the river had lots of sediment. And then even in 2016, we had some reds upstream of Glines Canyon Dam, suggesting they're getting into that upper watershed, or at least the lower stretches of it. Similarly, for Chinook salmon, just plotting through time, the red counts broken down into those same three reaches. So the black is below Elwha Dam, the gray is between the two dams, and then the red is above Glines Canyon. And you can see for the first time in 2016, we really had a noticeable number of spawners upstream of Glines Canyon Dam. So that really has just happened in the last year or so. In terms of diversity, I want to just tell a little anecdote or a sort of a narrative that's occurred in these two tributaries, Little River and Indian Creek. So coho have seemed more reluctant to push upstream than Chinook salmon. So the Lower Elwha Clallam tribe has been leading an effort to translocate adult coho salmon from their hatchery facility into these two tributaries. Those fish that have been translocated there have actually been really successful at spawning. In fact, they're producing smolt outmigrations from these two tributaries monitored by a smolt trap that are comparable to other densities in established coho salmon populations. Now, with respect to diversity, these two creeks or these two streams have very different habitats. So Little River is steeper, it's colder, and tends to produce a lot more fry outmigrants. So this smaller life history, you can see here on the left, these 70-millimeter fish, where Indian Creek is warmer, it's lower gradient, there's a series of wetlands that are phenomenally high-quality winter habitat for coho salmon. It drains a lake, so the flows are attenuated. And in that case, we've seen a much higher production of smolts. So this life history we're seeing over here on the right side. So these are fish that are silvery, black tip fins, they're headed straight to the ocean, whereas these fry that are coming out of Little River, perhaps rearing in other locations in the main channel or elsewhere downstream from Little River. So sort of brings me to a big question about how long recovery will take. It's certainly one that we entertain often, you know, amongst the fish group. And what I wanted to show here was simply just a real coarse conceptual model of how to think about recovery, because there's so many different aspects to this Elwha River ecosystem, and you might expect them to sort of respond at different temporal or time and spatial scales. So this graph is organized with smaller to larger spatial scales along the x-axis, from sites to reaches or subsections of the river to an entire watershed, and say response time to recovery from shorter times to longer times along the y-axis. And the point here is that some of the attributes of the physical habitat, turbidity, suspended sediment concentration, particularly at sites localized within the river, are actually already showing signs of significant recovery, and we're beyond that period when we feel that the river conditions are going to be inhospitable to fish. Other attributes, things like insect densities, juvenile fish densities, the way that the stream beds sort themselves into spawning gravels, might see conditions consistent with recovery at, say, kilometer or 10-kilometer reaches within the river. And in fact, with respect to juvenile fish densities, even though we haven't achieved our recovery goals, there are places in the watershed that seem alive with fish. Just talking to biologists in the last week or so, folks that are snorkeling and electrofishing, they're seeing high densities of steelhead and coho salmon and some of the tributaries, and that's really encouraging to see. But when you step up to the largest watershed scale and you talk about an entire salmon population encompassing over 100 kilometers of habitat, or you talk about seeing a forest reemerge from the bottom of a reservoir, it's going to take time. And with salmon, I think the important thing to remember is that each generation, depending on the species, is 2 to 5 years. So in terms of the outlook for the future and just some concluding remarks here, we've seen some really encouraging signs in response to dam removal. We know that fish are accessing those areas upstream of the dams. We've seen some areas of newly accessible habitat that have high densities of juvenile fish. And we believe that, or we have evidence that, this massive physical disturbance is really tapering off. However, sort of stepping back to the big picture and the long-term goals, we're still a long way from those, particularly abundance goals and spatial distribution and productivity goals for Chinook salmon and steelhead populations. And the need right now is to ensure that the colonists are reaching that newly accessible habitat and having opportunities to produce offspring that will return in future generations. Also want to emphasize that we've got a really strong collective monitoring team that is committed to collecting the right information to the best of our ability and using that information to inform how we're managing our hatcheries and our fisheries. And then lastly, in my opinion, this is just a really unique opportunity for salmon recovery. I do conduct my work in Puget Sound, and I'm convinced that it really is going to take high magnitude large impact actions to really have sort of meaningful, tangible, long-lasting benefits to salmon, and this is one of them, especially given that a lot of the habitat is protected within a national park. And then finally, just want to acknowledge the interagency team that's been collecting habitat data, fish data. Every time I work and meet with my collaborators, I'm inspired to do my best work. They're dedicated people, and they have really shaped my view of this river and how the fish are responding. And then lastly, be happy to take questions. This picture here is just looking upstream from Glidens Canyon Dam, so we'll head up in just a few minutes here, and that's the impact hammer that made it happen. So.
Any questions, commissioners? Commissioner McIsaac?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It wasn't clear to me in your presentation whether you think we're in the preservation stage, the recolonization stage, or the local adaptation stage. I'm pretty sure we're not in the viable net population stage yet.
Yeah, very good question.
Are we in recolonization now, in your opinion, or your categories?
Based on the way the guidelines are written, Commissioner McIsaac, we are in preservation. So we've hit all the metrics for abundance, 950 fish spawning in the river. We've hit the metric for spatial distribution, which is a significant portion accessing above Elwha Dam. What we're missing is we've not hit the metric for productivity. And really, the thing to emphasize there is that the fish that are returning now were produced by spawners that were exposed to those hostile river conditions while the dam removal was occurring. And so the way we've written those guidelines, we need to have 4 years of productivity data through adult returns, which would mean the earliest we could really, as we've laid out those guidelines, hit recolonization would be a couple years in the future, 2019.
So you're preserving the populations that were below the lower dam beforehand. And when I think of recolonizing and I see there's fish above where the dams were taken out, that seems like recolonizing to me. But you're talking about preserving the genetic structure that was there below the dams?
Exactly, yeah. So didn't touch on this yet, but one of the things to bear in mind with respect to particularly the Chinook salmon population is that it's really genetically unique with respect to the Puget Sound region and the Puget Sound evolutionary significant unit. So a lot of our Puget Sound Chinook salmon are closely related. If you can think of the genetic tree, Elwha and Dungeness are sort of way out here on their own. And so the hatchery has been sort of our primary tool to make sure that we're not going to have any risk of extinction and losing that long arm on the genetic tree while the dam removal is occurring. But, you know, there's clearly overlap in, you know, the titles of those phases. You know, fish are accessing areas upstream of the dam, and so there's no denying that recolonization is happening even while we're in this preservation phase.
Other questions? My question's probably for the hydrologists and not for you, but my favorite magazine, High Country News, just did an article on the Elwha restoration, and I was reminded reading the article that there's an even bigger project on the books in the next decade, and that's the Klamath River. I don't know whether they're comparable, and it looks like these were really high dams, but would it make sense to attempt sediment removal prior to breaching in large dam removals like this? And it may not have been possible given the height of those dams, it looks like, but I'm just...
Yeah, I'm really not qualified to answer that question. I do know that so a colleague with NOAA Fisheries, George Pess, hosted a group from the Klamath River Group and that came up to Port Angeles and toured the watershed, a couple days of meetings where we all sort of had an opportunity to share our work, and the goal was just sort of information sharing and lessons learned. And so hopefully, you know, if there were any opportunities for things like that, that they were presented.
Okay. Yes.
Commissioner, we have lots of people here who devoted a lot of their careers to this. If it pleases the commission, Pat Crane's here. He may be able to answer that question for you. Works for the National Park Service, and maybe have him come up just to answer a question for the commission.
Are commissioners okay with that?
Yeah.
Pat, we would welcome you.
Rob Ellison.
And we would welcome Rob as well.
Thanks for allowing me to come up. I might have jumped out of my seat otherwise. the question that you asked was a very good one, and one that as we went through the process of trying to decide how the dams should come out, we spent a lot of time on looking at, you know, what do you do with the sediment? That was really the biggest picture, especially not only the fish down below, but the city of Port Angeles had their domestic and industrial water supply coming out of the river. And so there was a need to ensure protection of that water supply. So through the NEPA process, removing sediment ahead of time was evaluated. For the Elwha River, the cost of the project became astronomical, and it was cheaper to figure out a way to protect the water supplies and preserve the fish than trying to either drain the reservoirs and then truck and haul, or they talked about slurrying sediment and putting it on a pipeline and sending it downstream. But this erosion, natural erosion, was selected for a number of reasons, but cost was really important. I think the other thing that we got because of natural erosion was rapid redevelopment of the estuary and shoreline, which we would not have gotten had that been trucked and hauled.
Interesting. Rob, would you like to add anything?
I'm wondering why Pat asked me up here now.
So, well, anything that you would like to add about your involvement?
Yeah, I mean, the estuary redevelopment is on reservation, and so it was very important. We had a very good beach down there as far as crab and clams were concerned, and we were very interested in having it reestablished. The beach had been eating away since the dams were put in, and we were continuously losing acreage, and I believe it's over 80 acres of new estuary area we have now on the reservation.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Just one thing, and again, this is kind of getting off track.
Thank you, Tom. I'm very interested in the function of your super depth finder there, the sonar unit that you use. You know, we have a lot of arrays in rivers and different systems that due to, you know, high flows in the spring, a lot of these are destroyed and are replaced, and it's kind of a constant battle. And I'd be curious to learn if the feasibility of using those more widely in rivers across the state to monitor returns and, you know, fish, you know, going downstream and fish coming back. Potential replace the arrays that are being currently used?
You know, in my opinion, it's got tremendous opportunity to improve the quality of our abundance estimates. The ability to basically record live imagery, you know, continuously is pretty advantageous in comparison to, say, red surveys. You get away from assumptions about site probability or fish per red. And so particularly in Western Washington, some of our glacially dominated streams, you know, I'm thinking, you know, Sauk in the Skagit system or Dungeness, right, where we almost every year have a period in April or May where you simply can't see the spawning beds. And, it also allows us to not only estimate abundance, but also the uncertainty around that estimate, so we can add some precision to our estimates of abundance. Would give some degree of how certain are we that number we're producing is the most accurate number.
Well, it's interesting. That really caught my eye because, you know, we'll go to a great time and expense to establish an array, and a good-sized log in spring comes down the river and pretty much does it in.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you've got the gear in the river, you are constantly monitoring the conditions, and the department has recently sort of dipped our toe in the pool and exploring a project out on the Ho River. We've got one. We're thinking about getting going on the Dungeness River as a means to just try to fill in some gaps when we simply can't conduct surveys and learn as much we can about migration timing and abundance.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I see Eric nodding his head in the background there. And, you know, we've entered the area of the whoosh. So, you know, now maybe we will be exploring the super sonar idea. I like it. Well, thank you very much, and it's something I'd like to learn more about.
Any further discussion, questions? Yes, Director.
I just want to comment. I wanted to acknowledge Robert Elson and Russ Hepfer. They're going to be on the tour with us. They're from the Lower Elwha Tribe, and thank you for welcoming us to your land.
Thank you.
Thanks for going along with this. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Okay, so with no further discussion, we will now move to our tour. After the tour, the commission will recess until 8 a.m. tomorrow.